Testing.
This is a interview with Mr. Target on the flood of 1955. Background information, I guess we can just start off as to, you said you were in the Army, the events that brought you home, and what led up to the flood, as you can recall.
Well, at the time I was in the Army stationed at Fort Dix, and when reports of the flood began coming over the news services and the wires came home, and I don't even remember now what day of the week it was. I immediately asked for an emergency leave, which was granted, and my wife and I came back to Danbury. My family had a laundry and dry cleaning business located at 2527 White Street, a business that had been started by my great-grandfather about 1879. The structure itself was a two-story, rather large building built directly over the river. The river, which, curiously enough, and ironically enough, known as the Still River, which if I can believe some of the old salts that told stories in Danbury, is the only river in North America that flows north. As its name implies, prior to August of 1955, it had been living up to its name for many, many years. It was not in an area that was constantly in danger of being flooded. The thought of a flood in downtown Danbury was something that had never, ever occurred to anybody. When I got home, the water had receded. And when I finally was able to get downtown to the location of laundry, which was run by my father and my uncle at that time, and my grandfather, the devastation on what had been White Street was something that is practically unimaginable. The debris, the mud and rocks and pieces of concrete and wood, basically, piled in the street itself were higher than a man's head. The laundry building itself, because it was of brick and concrete, structurally sustained no damage at all. It was just a situation where this bucolic river came in the back door and went out the front door, or vice versa. However, the present left by it was just mud on top of mud on top of mud. And the mud was of a silt-like quality. When it dried, it was almost like a pumice. And one of the tasks that was assigned to me was being handled a shovel and a wheelbarrow, and started shoveling this muck off the floors and what have you, and strangely enough, after you shoveled it off, your greatest hope was water to wash it down, which is rather ironic. You've been destroyed by water, and yet water is your ultimate cleanup material. The trucks, again, I don't know what time of day it struck. My guess is that it struck at night, because little was removed from the buildings. Nothing, to my knowledge, was removed from the buildings prior to that. So that all your office machinery, all your motors that ran the various equipment, the trucks, were all covered with water. And of course, when the water receded, you had your friend the mud. So that motors had to be removed from machines and rewound, dried out and rewound. Office machinery, some was salvaged, some wasn't salvaged, and you were working against time, because your enemy with anything wet is rust and corrosion, and if you can get to it quick enough, you can prevent the rust and corrosion, so that it will be washed down, wiped down, and then oiled to preserve whatever state you live. And of course your records, anything that was paper, if it wasn't so glued together, in those days, most of the stuff was done with pen and ink. Ledgers were illegible. And the fact that we were a laundry and dry cleaning establishment subjected us to a great many, the butt of many jokes as really being washed up. After a while, that got to be obviously a source of irritation as you're standing there in the middle of this devastation. I can remember the two United States senators from the state of Connecticut at that time coming down White Street to view the devastation, as politicians want to do. And the first one to arrive was George Bush's father, then Senator Prescott Bush from Greenwich, who, in my recollection, now whether I fantasize this or not because of my political leanings, but I remember Prescott Bush in a three-piece suit and shiny black shoes standing amid this constant wreckage, kind of mincing steps, trying to keep high and dry, followed by then-Senator Abraham Ribicoff, who arrived in a work shirt and wading hip boots. The contrast still remains in my mind, the aristocracy versus the rising other side. The many of the places had cellars, and of course the cellars remained flooded. And I can remember fire departments coming in from as far away as New York City and just pitching in and pumping out the basements and what have you. I think that somehow tragedy in this country has the ability to bind people together as no other event can do it. And the social and economic strata were ripped away, and everybody pitched in, and everybody was equal, and everybody had a shovel and a wheelbarrow and a willingness to help everybody out. I can remember the coffee and donut wagons of the Salvation Army and the Red Cross being brought in, and the assistance of everybody. The wooden structures on White Street suffered obviously the most damage. And as I say, the building that housed my family's business was concrete and steel and brick, and structural damage was nothing. It was just cleaning it out. And the building was two stories, and to my recollection, the second story suffered no damage at all. But the force of the water racing through the buildings and the roads just created canyons where canyons never existed before, and heaps of debris that just, you would stand there initially and say, we're never, ever going to be able to clean this up. And yet, slowly and surely, as each long journey begins with the first step, you are able to start in an area and clean it out. I think that I was able to remain around about 5 days. And when I left to go back to the service, the building was obviously not restored to a workable building. But my father and my uncle and my grandfather and the help, and I think at that particular time they must have had between 50 and 55 employees who just pitched in and did everything. And the business was able to reopen after the flood in August, only to be devastated again by the second flood in October. And maybe 2 years after that, my father and my uncle decided that none of the younger members of the family had any interest in it, and on a particular day they turned the key in the lock and threw the key in the river, and that was the end of that business. The buildings downtown, most of them were condemned, and the Danbury Redevelopment Agency was born, buildings were taken by condemnation, torn down, and White Street as it exists today, the linear route of White Street remains the same. It's wider, obviously. The starting on the corner of Main and White, on the right-hand side or south side, starting at Feinstein's Men's Store and going down, the buildings as far as where the river now crosses White Street are buildings that were standing in 1955, and out as far as Meeker's Hardware. On the left-hand side, or the other side of the street, no buildings between the corner of Main and White and the railroad tracks. Further out on White Street toward West County are pre-1955 buildings. The redevelopment of downtown, where the Amphenol building is now, was a neighborhood of stores and multiple family dwellings, which were devastated and obviously torn down. The route configuration in that area of town has totally changed. There's streets that no longer exist. The traffic pattern has totally changed. I don't remember the loss of life. I can remember only two fatalities, and they occurred down in Redding. But I would attribute that in retrospect to the fact that there were very few office buildings downtown. They were mostly retail establishments. And I would have to assume that the flood occurred in off business hours so that nobody was swept away by it, as it was in some of the areas of other areas of Connecticut, like Lynn City. Now I can talk and move through the valley and the Waterbury area. I think that the most vivid memories are the fact that the cooperation of everybody. I mean, people that did not even know each other or had anything to do with the area just seemed to converge upon it and pitch in and help. And that was the only warm feeling that you would get out of it. The fact that the weather was in August obviously made the cleanup a lot easier. Had it happened in the middle of winter or cold area of the fall, it would be totally different. But there were sights and sounds that no one would ever forget. I'm not happy to say that I lived through it, but by the same token, it's an experience that's unforgettable and unavoidable.
Now I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about daily life in downtown Danbury and how it was affected by the flood.
Prior to the flood, downtown Danbury was really a conglomeration of what are commonly referred to today as mom-and-pop stores. Many small stores run by families. Generally utilized by people who lived in the area. There was a great amount of population down there on streets that no longer exist, such as River Street and what have you, that was not a particularly mobile society as such. And to walk downtown, I happen to run to school at New Street School, which is now where the Central Firehouse is. As a younger person, lived on Spring Street, so that you had mobility to get downtown, and that's where your only mobility would get you, and you focused on downtown. I think the flood displaced a large segment of that population move them out of the center of town, and to the Main Street merchant, lost a great deal of what would be called walk-in trade. Today, there is no walk-in trade on Main Street. Ours is a mobile society. If you can't get there by car, you don't go. I mean, there's no, with the exception of a few neighborhoods where you would walk to the store to get a loaf of bread or to buy anything like that. And the stores downtown, long before the advent of the convenience stores, that's where your focus was. The improvements in the automobile have obviously changed our society, the way we shop and the way we think and the way we travel. I mean, people today think nothing of driving a half, three quarters of an hour to a shopping mall to get something that you used to be able to get downtown.
Were there a lot of automobiles destroyed then? You know, like.
Well, of course, anything that was parked down there was gone.
Swept away or just hurt in?
Some were swept away, and of course, by insurance company definition, any automobile in which the water rises higher than the floorboards is a total loss.
Never heard that. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's an insurance company standard. If the water rises above the floorboards, the vehicle's a total loss and has to be disposed of.
How did the insurance companies treat people? I mean, were they?
I don't even remember, and it's funny because I've worked for an insurance company for the last 38 years. Hopefully they treated them as well, if not better, than they do today.
Yeah.
People, insurance was not as universal then as it is now. But I think that they when people became mobile and traveled by car, when they got to a place, you had to have a place to put the car. And the downtown area just did not have those places. That coupled with the fact that what the downtown merchants had to offer that the malls did not have to offer is true today. Service, quality, and friendliness. And a lot of the next generation of people that took over the remaining stores did not exhibit that. And as a result, people said, I'm not going to pay more and be treated worse by shopping downtown and going to a Caldor or a Grand Way, which was one of the original stores downtown. Today, I mean, if you go to a mall, you don't expect to be treated as a person. There's no one-on-one contact. In the old days, living on Spring Street, going to New Street School, there was a river that ran behind New Street School, and one of our favorite tricks at the end of recess would be to kick the ball over the fence so it went into the river. And then, of course, we would have to hightail it down to retrieve the ball as it floated down the river. And I can always remember we would always stop at Boab's Market to pick up some penny candy or at Jimmy's across the street. So that it was more of a communal atmosphere than it is today. I mean, the sensitivity between people today just doesn't exist the way it did in those days. It was a collective, protective, user-friendly society, which is just not existent today. We live insulated lives. Our neighbors are strangers. So those you cannot retrieve those days, and Danbury's downtown fell victim to it.
What do you think would happen if like something like that were to happen today? I mean, you're saying that people came together in a great deal. Do you think it would happen in the same instance?
I think that the only remaining thing in our society that reduces the socio-economic, religious, ethnic, racial, whatever standard that you might want to put, is a tragedy, and that's the only time that the American people can seem to coalesce into a workable unit without forming committees and getting into arguments over who does what. I think that it's If you go to a ball game today, if you go to a football game today, you can't go to a football game, whether it's a high school football game, a college football game, or a professional game, without seeing two or three fights in the stands. The same way with baseball. And yet, tragedy reduces everybody to the same level, and differences are forgotten. And I think that probably, a tragedy, yes, I think that would bring people together. But that's a sad state, a sorry state, and I certainly wouldn't suggest that we create a tragedy to bring out the best in people.
And like you said, how it united them. I mean, our people, I know when my father discusses it, and I spoke to you about that, are like, when you talk about it, can you remember, like, the guy that was standing next to you shoveling?
Oh, sure.
You know, like, that's a story that'll be with.
And it could be somebody that you knew, or it could be somebody that you had never seen before in your life.
Met people, you made new friends.
And you made friends, and it was not a measurement of you're doing more than I am, or I'm doing more than you are, and we'll spend some time arguing about that. Whether you picked up six shovels and I picked up four, or vice versa.
Just help out your neighbor.
Just help your neighbor.
And sure.
I don't know. It's an ingredient that's, to use a flood term, has washed its way out of society.
You know, I'm just thinking about, what happened to, like, the sewer systems in Danbury? Did they back up? Did they?
I mean, was there storm sewage? Drains. The storm drains were obviously too small to carry the flood of water. I mean, it was surface water, but they were bubbling out of the storm drains.
Was sewage coming out with it, or no?
I don't recall that, because, see, they were downtown businesses.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was, but I mean, as I don't recall sanitation being an overwhelming problem. I have no recollection whatsoever.
More of destruction?
Just
property.
Utter destruction rather than sanitation or searching for bodies and loss of life and things like that.
How long did it take for most businesses to get back going again? Like you said, there was a period between August or October and August.
Well, most of them were geared back up by the time October hit all over again. So then I would say within 30 days, most businesses were back on their feet. Again, depending upon finances and whether they were able to replenish your inventory. It would depend upon the type of business. If you were there were a couple of liquor stores on White Street that I recall. And any liquor that's damaged like that has to be destroyed by the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Division. It's taken to the dump and dumped. So, I mean, you lose your total inventory. And whether you've got the finances to replenish the stock, who knows? So each business was really, some businesses never came back.
How about like the roads? How long did they, was that an immediate project? Because I have seen pictures of like the pavement overlapping.
Buckled. Oh, the pavement buckled and rose, and they had huge chunks torn out. That was done pretty rapidly.
That's interesting.
Because it was really not a large segment of downtown that was devastated. Down what's now Elm Street, which was then Elm Street.
Right.
Rose Street, Franklin Street, White Street, and Main Street. I was trying to remember how far up Main Street the flood went, and it didn't go very far.
Past the post office?
If it got to the post office, that was about as far as it got.
Yeah.
So that you really had a concentrated area that had to be repaired.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to remember, and I have no recollection whatsoever as to the utilities.
Oh, sure. I didn't think
the lights and of course, it was the summertime, and you didn't need heat.
Mm-hmm.
And air conditioning was really not widespread at that point at all. But I would guess within 30 days,
things were smooth.
Normalcy had, or you could exist.
Was that the same after October, or was it harder for these businesses to start up after October?
Well, it was harder, obviously, because you've been devastated twice. I mean, how many times do you have to get hit before you just want to lay down and stay down?
Yeah.
again, I don't have the... your resources for that would be the newspaper, would be the Jerry Davis of Mill Plain, or Great Plain, the town historian.
How far was, like, coverage about this? Were people speaking of this in, you know, in California? Was this a national event, or...
Because you didn't have the media that you have today. Right,
sure.
I mean, in those days, the TV programs were You Are There, but that You Are There was Washington Crossing the Delaware, things like that. And it's not CNN where, and as it happens, you're there. So that it was print media and voice media. And of course, there were towns that were more seriously devastated than they were, had greater devastation.
Mm-hmm.
Things like Winston, Torrington, the Waterbury, the Naugatuck Valley. So I would have to assume that the... We didn't really have a lot of time to read a newspaper.
Yeah, you're too busy.
But, as far as today's media hype, the TV cameras and newsreel trucks and current edition and whatever you work really in.
Yeah.
I think that that eliminates the theatrical people who do things to be seen. People in those days did things to do them. I think that as anybody knows today, if the television camera shows up, the mood of any group changes, and the performance is more for the media than for the situation. That's about using the water term, drains me.
Yeah, well, I thank you. You know, everything you've given us is definitely helpful.
You got to get a hold of a copy of that flood book.
Yeah, do you know of, like, anybody else? What was the name?
I'm sure the library. It's a soft cover book with various scenes and activities that are going on, and pictures of the devastation.
Any other people or things you could recommend?
Jerry Davis.
Out
in Great Plain, resident historian. Lucy Boland, who used to be at the Scott family. She has many photographs. And again, most of the people that manned the businesses in those days are no longer in business, and they just don't exist. I try Meeker's Harbor.
True, yeah.
Tried Brandon Smith, I didn't remember the first thing I ever did. That's it. There are resources, and one will turn up another. And
sure.
It'll gradually mushroom for us.
Just like you did for us.
Yeah. Have no trouble at all.
Great.
Thank you guys for the opportunity. I know. You're home.
All right, Mr. Target, I appreciate it, and we'll kill it off right there.